Thank you. I thought, I guess I wasn't here for this. I'm not usually here on Mondays, I'm not usually here on Fridays, so I don't really know what happened in this discussion on Friday. It's not relevant except that we all know that the question of whether there's a string phenomenology or not is an interesting one, an important one, and not one to which we really know with great confidence the answer. But there have been a lot of elements of progress over the last 3 years or so. And that's really sort of why some of us felt this would be an appropriate time to have this workshop. And so I want to explain a little bit what it is that what it is that's going on, what it is that we're trying to do, what we're hoping to accomplish, and maybe to explain even the fact that not everyone views this moment in quite the same way, and there are different directions that people are exploring. So I thought I'd put a little outline up here. Don't worry, I mean, it's a lot of things, but I'm not going to spend too much. One could spend days on all of them, but I'm only going to spend a few minutes on each one.
Why did you erase the word optimism at the bottom?
I didn't notice that showed. I actually have a couple more ideas. So I have two words here. I just thought it was really dangerous to have the second word, which you can also see I started to write, and that's where I got paused, but I'll put it up there. Okay, so, you're not supposed to be a pessimist, and I thought maybe I should erase that. And I'm not a pessimist, but there are causes for concern and so that I had there. And there are actually a couple other items that were in this that I didn't quite write down. Anyway, so you can read this outline for yourself. I'm just going to go through this kind of step by step. So first of all, state of high energy physics. Okay, what do I have in mind there? Well, you've all been bored to death, I think, by hearing about talks about the successes of the standard model. But from the point of view of particle physics and particle theorists in particular, the successes of the standard model are in some ways a disappointment. We'd like to find clues to new physics, or really find new physics. And so, of course, there have been great successes in precision tests of the theory. There have been, in the last few years, a whole aspect of the theory that we really haven't explored before has been subjected also to exploration of the tests. And this is the question of CP violation. And this was a good chance for the standard model to fail. And while not everything at the moment is necessarily quite in perfect shape, it looks, there's no obvious, at the moment, no obvious smoking gun of a problem here. So the standard model, again, as I say, is working very well. We have a couple very interesting discoveries, or really one interesting discovery, which is neutrino mass. And one can discuss whether or not one thinks neutrino masses fit, in what sense they fit in the standard model. But neutrino masses were certainly expected. Their actual values are interesting. Okay, they're actually perhaps a little larger than I, for example, might have guessed. And this points perhaps to some new, perhaps very high energy, but not quite as high as one might have supposed. So maybe, we don't know what it is, but 10 to the 11th to 10 to the 14th GeV or something like that. Some large scale, but a scale well below the Planck scale, well below the unification scale. And so this is actually something interesting and something we want to be keeping in mind as we consider all these other questions, that we have some indications that nature is not so simple as some of us might have imagined or guessed.
Question?
Yeah.
Why is it expected?
Because, basically, you just ask. You say, take the standard model, and what we usually do is we write down the renormalizable terms, the marginal and relevant operators. But if you start less, you just write down the irrelevant operators, and you say what so there's some operator which is basically two leptons and two Higgs fields. And this is dimension 5. It's got some mass scale in front here, and now you start guessing what should the scale be.
Allowed operator.
It's an allowed operator, and the question is, and I say, and the real issue is, what's the scale here? And people for a long time wanted to put something like a unification scale here. All kinds of unified models predict this, for example. And the scale, it's interesting that the scale, looks like it could be significantly smaller. So now that's fine. What about, so if we're theorists and we want something to do, we want to ask what are the limitations of the standard model? Okay, and of course, listing these is relevant if we're going to talk about string theory, because one of the things we want to ask is whether string theory resolves any of these. Okay, and so there are a few. One we all like to point out is there are lots of parameters. And there's nothing really wrong with that. And there's certainly nothing wrong. Often it's said, you can explain anything with, 17 parameters. That's fallacious. There are really very few parameters that are really relevant to understanding most of the data which the theory explains. But still, one would like at some level to, one thinks one to be able to understand a lot of these things. Where do they come from? So that's one question. One parameter is particularly peculiar, and I'm going to mention this because it's, again, we're going to encounter it when we talk about string theory. There's something called the Strunk-CP problem, and this is because there is actually a dimension 4 term in the theory which violates CP. Corresponding to that, there's a dimensionless parameter called theta, or often called theta QCD, and we know that this number has to be very small, less than 10 to the minus 9 or 10 to the minus 10. Okay, so it's a pure number. Okay, and yet we live in a world where CP is violated. Okay, so the question is, why is that so? Okay, another peculiarity of these parameters is just the smallness of the Higgs mass. Okay, well, in some sense, we haven't seen the Higgs, so the Higgs mass is really obviously in some level pretty big. And in fact, one of the things that we're pretty much guaranteed to do at the Large Hadron Collider is find it. Okay, so we don't know what it might be. It might be anywhere from something like 116 GeV up to maybe 200 or so. Could even really be larger, but it's kind of a range that we talk about. But this is a puzzling number from another point of view, because we know that there are very large numbers in nature. I mean, I've mentioned this one. We've mentioned the possibility of some very large number associated with neutrinos. We have the Planck scale. Okay, so why is this so small compared to those numbers? And this is known as the hierarchy problem. Okay. All right. Then there are other things that are wrong with this theory. We know there's lots of dark matter, and there's no candidate for dark matter. I don't want a better piece of chalk. There's no candidate for the dark matter, so it's a big piece part of the universe we can't explain. We can't explain why there is matter at all, why there's an asymmetry between baryons and antibaryons. And I've saved the best for last, the one that string theorists always like to announce, and this is the fact that this theory doesn't incorporate gravity. So if you just try and sort of tack general relativity onto this story, it doesn't work. It doesn't. You get results which don't make sense. And so. So what have people said about these problems? Of course, people have thought about these issues for a long time, and what have people said? Okay, well, maybe I'll just make a list. So for many parameters, we don't really have a good answer, haven't had a good answer to this. We have one, which we explain. We have something called grand unification. Okay, and this at least explains, gets rid of one, sometimes two, maybe another one or two. Okay, this one, for example, gives us the value of the strong coupling. Okay, in terms of the weak and electromagnetic coupling, so it gets rid of one parameter. That's not necessarily huge progress, but it's impressive. The strong CP problem There are various proposals to deal with this. One the, sort of the most famous and most probably the most plausible in many ways, is known as an axion, a light particle. Light particle whose role is basically to cancel off this theta parameter. And it's interesting also because if it's there, it can be the dark matter. It can rather naturally be the dark matter. The smallness of the Higgs mass, there are a variety of ideas. Okay, there's something called technicolor, which is some new strong interaction. So this Higgs particle is a composite of other strongly interacting particles. Okay, there are various other ideas. There's something called large extra dimensions and other things. I don't have time to talk about all these. In fact, I'm going to mainly focus on one, which is known as supersymmetry. Okay, and this is not to denigrate the others. Okay, I mean, I think people here are thinking about all these kinds of possibilities. Okay, people in this workshop, but I mentioned this one just because it's sort of compact and it has kind of easier. It's relatively easy to understand what its consequences are. And it has a number of interesting consequences. It has consequences for accelerators. So if it's there, and if these ideas are right, we're sort of bound to see it. And I think you heard a lot about that from Gordy and his talk at the LHC. It also gives rise to a dark matter candidate, quite naturally. And this unification I mentioned really doesn't work unless we have supersymmetry. Okay, so I said that as if that kind of comes easily, but you need this other part of the story too for that to work. Okay, so supersymmetry has some successes, but it's also something we should see. Okay, so that's fine. So particle theorists have spent a lot of time over, I don't want to say how many years, thinking about these various possibilities, and those of us who have are, you know, quite excited about this new era we're entering, this Large Hadron Collider era, where we're finally going to really decide whether many of these ideas are true. Okay. Let me say a couple words, though, about these ideas themselves. So I sort of had a list of limitations of the standard model. I could say limitations of these other ideas. Okay. So let me mention a couple for the axion. Okay, the axion is a nice idea, but actually when you look at it in practice, from the point of view of a field theorist, it's kind of weird. In fact, it's not all that natural. So I'll say it's rather unnatural from the point of view of a theorist, of a field theorist. And there are a lot of ways to say that. People have discussed that in a lot of ways, but basically, having this light particle which can do this job, which can cancel off this theta, requires a potential that's very, very tiny. Okay, so it requires that the mass and all the terms in the potential for this field be very small. Typically what people do is they say, let's impose a symmetry to account for that. Okay, so they impose a symmetry, but sort of by construction, the symmetry has to be broken. So you impose a symmetry, it's not a symmetry, you don't think the symmetry can be true in a theory which includes general relativity. Okay, so this is a rather troubling idea. Okay, supersymmetry has all kinds of problems. It has the problem we haven't seen it yet. Okay. But apart from that one, it raises puzzles as well. Things like why this whole structure was guessed to say why is there a light Higgs particle. And yet, it's not that easy to get a light Higgs particle. You know, so people sort of would say, let's just declare there's a light Higgs particle. And it kind of looks better than in the standard model, but it's still rather strange, okay, the way people put this forward. Okay, so I just mentioned these as two. And if I had gone through these others, each of them comes with a long list of positives and negatives, but I took supersymmetry again because I think just the list of negatives, the list of things you have to try and explain in these other cases is larger. Yeah.
It's confusing in the sense that the natural supersymmetry gas exists there.
Well, no, since this isn't meant to be an advertisement for string theory in a moment, I actually have something else in mind, so I should straighten out the confusion that I created, even for the experts. So what I meant is that if I imagine I had some microscopic theory, like a grand unified theory, we'll come to string theory in a moment, you would say, why is the Higgs not, why is the mass of the Higgs not of order the unification scale? Which I mentioned before, I didn't really talk about it, but it's, we're going to think of it something like 10 to the 16th GeV. Okay, so some very large number, much larger than the scales of weak interactions, which are 10 to the 2 or 10 to the 3. There's a finer question, which I won't talk about, which is why is it 10 to the 2, why not 10 to the 3, or vice versa. Okay, but I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to just worry about this rough question. Okay, so that's my standard model story. Okay, and I want to come back now, and I want to ask, or I want to come now to string theory. Okay, so to what is string theory? Okay, so I'm not going to give you a lecture on string theory, obviously, and you have all the experts here. But just to say, in string theory, we're in the standard model, and we think of particles as points. We describe them by fields, quarks and leptons by fields. We don't assign them any attributes other than things like charges and masses. Okay. So, but you might say, that seems kind of silly. What's the simplest thing one could do beyond that? And the simplest thing you could do beyond that is imagine that your fundamental entities have one-dimensional extent, that they're strings. And I'm not, of course, describing this in any historical way, but when you do that, you just kind of follow your nose. You demand that the theory be Lorentz invariant, obey the rules of quantum mechanics, and just a little bit careful. You find in this way, you find when you do this, some number of five or so string theories, with a number of remarkable properties. Okay, so this simple-minded thing gives you a number of remarkable properties, and these are really the reasons why, what gives string theory its traction in some sense. Okay, so one is you get general relativity, because you don't put it in, you just find it there. You get gauge interactions like those of the standard model. You get particles like quarks and leptons. You get other fields, let's say. Okay. You get some of these things I talked about before. You get supersymmetry. Okay. You get other things. I guess I should mention you get axions. Let me say that here. I'll come to that in a minute. Okay? All right. Now, one of the things that's happened, of course, this was true already, we certainly would have said this 20-some years ago. Okay. What we've understood in the last 10 years is that, in fact, these theories are really all, in some sense, part of some larger theory of quantum gravity. So there's a sense in which these theories can all be thought as different limits of some theory, and in various limits, then this theory, whatever it is, can be described as a string theory of one or another type. So there's some perturbation expansion and a set of rules you can give. Okay, there are limits where it's not that at all. There are limits where it looks like a field theory in some number of dimensions. Okay, or there are limits where it looks like a conformal field theory in various dimensions. There are limits where it looks like a quantum mechanics. Okay, there are all sorts of things. So we know a lot about this theory, but we don't really know what the whole structure is. Okay, so Joe, from time to time, promises that this quarter he's going to figure out what it is. This semester, I mean. But we know a lot about it, but we don't know what the whole story is by any means. Okay. But it does have some successes. Okay. So I have this list, and there are lots of things we know about this thing, even though we don't know all of it. Okay. So for example, it can describe, you know, it's often said to be 10-dimensional or 11-dimensional, but it certainly can perfectly well describe many possible 4-dimensional worlds. Okay, many of which look awfully close to the world we see. So you can find, and in fact, a lot of what we've heard about in this talk is lots of constructions of worlds, if you like, with three generations, with a standard model gauge group, three generations of quarks and leptons, all sorts of things like that. It describes also, of course, many, if you like, alternative realities, many more. Where things are 8-dimensional or 9-dimensional or 10-dimensional or all sorts of other things. Okay? But this fact that it can come so close to describing what we see is one of the reasons that it has always has attracted so much interest.
To what extent can one really work out the low energy, field theory that comes out of these string theories to know that it? Well, for example, does it have 17 parameters?
Yes, you can work out. You can for a particular choice for some particular choices, you can work out almost everything. Okay, so for example, for states with a lot of supersymmetry, it's rather easy to work out the low energy Lagrange, to figure out what the light fields are, to work out their interactions. Easy, I say, in the sense of being straightforward, sometimes actually easy, to work out their interactions. Okay, there is some nice four-dimensional effect. You can integrate out some this complicated structure and write down some nice four-dimensional effective action which describes it. Okay, and you can compute the parameters in it.
I mean, you have to break supersymmetry, and you have to get mass. Ultimately, get mass.
Right. Okay. Oh, so well, this is the level of the question. Yes. Yes. So as you get to finer details, the problems get harder, and I'm going to talk about that. That's going to be what. That's this. That's part of this problem. So there's a kind of nice, if you look from a distance, there's kind of at this stage a nice picture. This I'm sort of saying why do people get excited? What is then as you start looking at the details, there are a lot of things that are problematic, and we're going to see that throughout. And if it were easy, I would just come and tell you the end. Yeah. Yeah. I would just tell you the answer. I would tell you whether the theory is true or not, and I would it'd be done. Okay, so, all right. So let's go on then, since we're at this point. Let's go on. So these are, I want to mention a couple other things. I want to mention things that are related to this. Okay, a couple things that are remarkable about string theory, apart from the fact that it has general relativity and quantum mechanics and so on, is in fact that it does, when you write down among these possible four-dimensional worlds, when you start to write down things that look close to what we see, okay, you find, in fact, axions. Okay, and I said this was these are puzzling objects from the point of view of field theory, but they're just there in the string theory. You find supersymmetry in the sort of way that people conjectured it would be relevant to accelerators. Okay, and you find things like light Higgs. Okay, now again, when we get to the details, there are going to be troubles. Okay, but again, in this kind of coarse-grained picture, if you like, of this story. Okay, there are a number of things that are remarkable. Okay, and that bear on these sorts of questions that I raised before. Okay, so I think I've run out of good things to say. I think I'm ready for obstacles. Okay, so what are the problems? And I just want to make sure Okay. Well, I sort of alluded to what the big problem is. One of the big problems here is just that at this level, I said there are lots of possibilities. So when people, there are really lots of possibilities. So for example, there are lots of classical solutions of the classical equations of the theory. Okay. And well, what you mean by that in these different descriptions is different. So in the string theory, you mean string theory limits, you mean constructing conformal field theories. In the field theory limit, you typically mean solving some set of classical equations and constructing some arguments that there's an exact solution. Okay. But there are lots of these. Okay. And we don't have a, you know, there's nothing that jumps out as a principle or something that chooses one over another. And of course, a lot of them don't look anything like what we see. As I say, there are things in the wrong number of dimensions. There are things with lots of supersymmetry that we don't see. There are all sorts of things like this. Okay, so this is one problem. Okay. A second problem is connected with the existence of what are called moduli. So essentially, all these constructions we know, all these simple constructions that we know, have massless fields. Massless scalar fields, at least classically. And at one level, as a theorist, these are good things because what they do, these scalar fields, the expectation values of these scalar fields, determine things like the coupling constants of the theory. So in fact, so classically you can think of it this way. There's some field which I can call, I'll call it 1 over g squared, sort of some characteristic coupling, okay? And it has no potential. Okay, so classically I'm free to sit here if I want where the coupling is small, or I can go out here where the coupling is very small, and I have all, all the tools of weak coupling and semi-classical methods and so on to analyze this theory as well as I can hope to do. Okay. But the downside of this is, of course, I want to know what this field does. And in fact, when people say sometimes that string theory is a theory with no parameters, what they mean is that all the parameters, all these 17 parameters or whatever we're going to look at, are determined once we figure out what are the expectation values, what dynamics shapes these moduli. So of course, what you'd like is you'd like to discover, there's really, when you do quantum mechanics or something, there's a potential like this. You know, we sit here, okay, everything will turn out to be nice, and that would be great. The problem is, if you just think about this for a moment, if you think about what any calculation is going to look like, I could even use color. Not very good color, though. Here. If I calculate the potential for this thing, what it's really going to do at weak coupling, okay, whatever I do, it's going to get smaller. Okay, and whenever you can do this calculation, this is how it looks. Okay, and then in some region of strong coupling, it may do something here. You know, maybe something good happens, but we don't have a way to get in there, and it's also puzzling because the couplings we see in nature are all rather small. Why should we be sitting over here? Okay. Finally, there's another problem here, which is, what is the value of, if you like, the energy, or since this is a theory of gravity, the value of the cosmological constant at the minimum, okay? And this puzzle is one of the greatest puzzles and has been one of the greatest obstacles to thinking about a string phenomenology. And I'm going to say a lot more about this in a moment, but basically we know that V0, the ground state energy here, whatever it is, okay, is some number. Okay, when people first started doing this, we knew it was something less than of order, 10 to the minus 46. In some particle physics units, GeV to the fourth, so some crazy number. Okay, now we know actually it's a non-zero number, okay, a small non-zero number. And we have no way to understand where this might come from. I mean, the characteristic scales in this theory, however we think about it, are generally, in these same units, the Planck scale is 10 to the 19th GeV or something. So if you raise that to the fourth power, that's like 10 to the 76 or whatever it is. Okay. So this puzzle, this problem has been an obstacle. Okay, from the start. Okay, so how do we get off the ground? How do we figure out where we're supposed to look? What determines these parameters and so on? Okay. So let me pause for a moment, though, and say that there are some interesting things that one has been able to do. And I even propose a this little parenthetical remark. Maybe it refers to the talk on, to your conversations on Friday. There's lots of talk in all these critiques of falsification, and it's actually kind of amusing how this goes. But I want to mention a few things that we do know. So before some of the recent progress I'm going to describe, there were things one could do. Okay, one could explore, one could use string theory, and I understood sort of well enough to explore at least the plausibility of ideas for physics beyond the standard model. Okay, and for example, I think there are a list of things that we learned that look plausible, of things that people have discussed and things which don't, and also some general features we've learned. So for example, in building models of particle physics, okay, people have sort of guessed that a quantum theory of gravity, okay, would not admit continuous global symmetries. Okay, and this actually was, for example, a lot of this question about the Pache-Quinn symmetry, the axion, which I mentioned before. Okay, and in fact, one of the kind of interesting things about string theory is in any limit where we understand that it has, in fact, no continuous global symmetries. Okay, so you can show that. So there are things we know, even though lots of things we don't. When people talked especially about supersymmetry, but also about theories of quark and lepton masses, one of the things they often did is they often said, let's impose discrete symmetries, okay, Z2 or Z3 or some permutation symmetry. Okay, and when they did that, certainly when I talked about things like that in the context of supersymmetry, people would jump on me and say, well, that's not plausible. Why are you doing that? Well, you know, it's totally artificial. One of the things that's very interesting in string theory is these sort of discrete symmetries are, in some sense, I'll talk maybe a little more about this later. They occur, and they might even, in some sense, be said to be common. Okay, so that's another thing, another question that we had about physics beyond the standard model. I've mentioned Pache-Quinn symmetries. I'll just put that in my list, or axions. Okay. And then these are sort of positive things. There are a number of things that we also realized that are unlikely. And Joe will recognize why I'm saying some of these things. So one of them is that time variation of the fundamental constants, and I mean here on cosmic timescales, okay? Fundamental constants on cosmic timescales, the kind of thing that people, for example, talked about in quasars and elsewhere, is implausible in theories like this. And related to that, the idea is associated with quintessence. They're very hard to understand. Hard to realize. Okay. Since I'm on cosmology, I'll also say, I'm not going to prove to you why these things are true or not true, but I'm just going to make a little list. There's something called natural inflation, which I think at least some of the people in the back of the room know what that is. Okay. And that also turns out to be very hard to realize in a theory like this. Okay. Since I'm on rather exotic things, lots of people like to write papers about CPT violation. Okay, well, maybe if you have a fundamental theory, there's CPT violation. One of the neat things you can prove rather reasonably easily in any context, well, first of all, in perturbation theory and string theory, it's a good short homework exercise for students to prove it. Even I can do it. In the cases where we have a non-perturbative formulation of the theory at our disposal, you can prove it then as an exact statement. So it's not to say, I don't know that we know that there isn't some corner of the theory where that doesn't happen, but it again looks very hard. It looks unlikely. Joe's making faces, maybe he's going to argue with me later. There are very specific proposals. There's a proposal for a spectrum of supersymmetric models, for example, which is known as anomaly mediation. Actually, I don't mean all of it. For the experts, I mean the scalar spectrum in that theory. So this is a kind of neat. I counted, there are 600 papers in the SPIRES database, at least on this topic. Okay, and again, but the plausibility of the setup that's required there is something you can explore using methods we understand in string theory, and you can show it looks pretty unlikely. So this kind of, so until things happened recently when I was trying to figure out what to do with my time, a lot of what I did is I said, oh, at least I can show a lot of things that don't happen in string theory. Okay, and then I you can think about. When I thought about that, I realized that maybe I agreed with Lenny that falsification isn't all that interesting. but there are a lot of things we learn from these theories, okay, as laboratories, if you like, for talking about our theoretical ideas. Okay, but I want to turn now, I think I'm doing okay, to sort of recent theoretical progress. And I'm going to be ahistorical, and to a large degree, I'm not giving I can't possibly give all the appropriate citations. Okay, so a lot of people have been involved in this. But the progress I'm referring to is actually in understanding this problem, this awful picture I drew. Okay, so we're actually now in a situation where we often can draw some, write down a system and draw some potential for it, for these moduli. I understand where the minimum is. Sometimes really have small parameters at the minima and do computations. And this has been associated with lots of people, certainly Steve, Joe, Shamit, the Beckers. Lots of people have been involved in these developments. And I want to describe just one version of this story. Okay, so I should say, first of all these ideas involve taking recent developments in string theory, using the things we've learned about brains and fluxes, okay, to sort of complicate the stories that people dealt with in the early days of string theory. So by taking, for example, some compactification of string theory. I haven't mentioned the word, but one of these Galabial compactifications. And adding these sorts of structures. So brains here can be membranes or generalizations, three brains, four brains, five brains. Okay. Fluxes are generalizations of the electric and magnetic fluxes we know from electricity and magnetism, but to fields with potentials which often have more indices, or potentials which often have, so the vector potentials, if you like, the analogs of the vector potentials have two or three indices, for example, and so on. Okay. So there are many sorts of things like this which we've come to understand. We've come to understand more about in string theory. Okay, and we've understood that we can add these to the structures we talked about before and create a much richer set of possibilities. Okay, so I want to list something, a development that's actually relatively recent, but I think it sort of encapsulates what the success here, and this is due to DeWolf. Never spelled his name correctly. Yuryevets, Kotru and Taylor. Okay. And they studied a set of a particular type of string theory known as the 2A theory. And they took a particular compactification of this. This was really meant to be illustrative. Okay, but basically, you start with this theory in 10 dimensions. You take 6 of the dimensions to be compact, and they just basically took it to be a product of 3 tori. I'm not drawing it very well, but I'll just draw it like that. Not drawing well at all. This is supposed to be 30 degrees. I don't know if it looks like that. It's not really that important. But that's some particular compactification of the theory on tori, and they introduced various sorts of fluxes. So in this theory, the reason that 2A is important is the different theories have different sorts of fluxes and topological objects you can introduce. Okay, read Joe's book. Okay, So there are various fluxes, and in this case they had what are called two-form fluxes. So these are really like magnetic fluxes, electric fluxes, four-form fluxes. Okay, so these are some generalization. And something called a zero-form flux. And I'm just going to write down, I'm not going to derive this, but it's actually pretty not hard to derive the potential they find. So first of all, what are the moduli in this case? Okay, so the moduli are the areas of these, corresponding the areas of these tori. So there are fields whose expectation value determine the areas of these tori, and I'll just call these, like they do, V1 and V2 and V3. Okay. So these determine the areas of the tori. And then there's also a coupling constant, a dimensionless coupling, which they write, so there's some g squared, called g string squared, which is conventionally written like this, as e to the 2 phi. Okay? And for this thing, with this combination of fluxes, okay, they write down a potential, and I'm going to just write it here, just for fun. So there's v, and it's p squared over 4. And then there's e to the 2 phi over v1, v2, v3 squared. So I just want to write this down. Just I'm not going to write a lot of formulas today, but just to show that one can be reasonably explicit. Okay, p is, I didn't have it in my list, but there's also a three-form flux. So p is, and I should say all these fluxes like Dirac's magnetic flux are quantized. Okay. So p is some integer which characterizes this three-form flux. Okay, there's something involving the four-form fluxes. So I'll just write it like that. Okay, so these are these moduli, the same moduli here, e to the 2 phi is this coupling, ei squared vi squared, e to the 4 phi, over v1, v2, v3 cubed. Okay. There's some other flux, m naught squared over 2, e to the 4 phi over v1, v2, v3. And then there's some crucial minus sign here and square root of 2, m naught p e to the 3 phi over v1, v2, v3. The three halves. Okay. And all these powers and things may look rather weird, but they're actually followed by some simple scaling arguments and so on. You can figure out sort of how this potential there works without having to be quite as serious calculators as these authors. Okay. So the qualitative features of this thing are actually easy to work out. There's also, I should say, another object in here, kind of neat object, again, due to Joe. There's an orientifold. So again, this is one of these newer developments that it's very important in this story, and that orientifold is responsible for that minus sign in the potential. Okay? And the result of this, if you graph this, is it looks indeed something. Actually, I don't know exactly how it looks, but it looks roughly like that. Roughly like this.
So the motivation was to find a minimum. Is that?
Yeah, the motivation here is to find a minimum. Okay, this is not the real world. Don't worry. We're not there yet. But the motivation here is to find a minimum. Okay, and in fact, the minimum occurs at V. That's right. These VIs is 1 over EI square root some number 5/3 E1, E2, E3 over kappa M naught. Okay? And I should write e to the phi, I just write goes as this e1, e2, e3 to the minus 1/4. Okay. So what you're supposed to see from these formulas is that the v's, as the e's become large, okay, the v's grow, and the coupling constant becomes small. Okay. So the two things that happen. One is we've got we found the minimum of these potentials, and we found them in a way that arguably is controlled, okay, in the sense that as we take these numbers large, the parameters become small. And in fact, this addresses a sharper version of what I described here. Okay, so the problem, in some sense, in string theory was, how would we find minima of the potential in a controlled approximation? What was the parameter? Okay. And in this theory, the claim is that these fluxes provide such a parameter. That by that we have an infinite sequence of choices of ground state in which the couplings get weaker and weaker. Yeah.
So we'll determine the fluxes?
The fluxes at this moment are free numbers. So there are, at this point, an infinite number of possible choices of these fluxes and an infinite number of possible choices of ground state.
So we've traded arbitrary choice of...
Yes.
One's an integer.
Yes. So it's good and bad. Well, first of all, fortunately, this is not the real world. Okay. And there are arguments, and we will argue a lot in this workshop about whether... So I didn't write the formula for it, but the energy here is in fact negative. This is described, all of these are some kind of anti-de Sitter space. We already knew in string theory we had, thanks to Maldacena, for example, we already knew we had infinite numbers of ADS spaces. So the that infinity by itself is something we have to think about, but it's not a surprise. It's not something, okay. What is new here is we actually have something here which has little or no supersymmetry. Okay. So the earlier Maldacena constructions, for example, had a lot of supersymmetry. We didn't know what to do about that. We didn't have examples with no supersymmetry. And this is closer to the kinds of things we'd like to build if we were going to try and describe, if we imagined along these lines, we would try and describe the world we see. Okay. So I want to come back, though. I want to say infinity may not be good, but large numbers are good. And why am I going to say might be good? This is the point where I get disinvited. I want to turn now. I think I'm in order. Yeah, I want to turn to this question of the dark energy. Okay. So I mentioned before that one of the puzzles in string theory from the beginning has been how do we understand the cosmological constant? Okay. And this problem can be understood at a number of levels, and people worried about this well before they worried about string, knew much about string theory. Okay, so what's the puzzle? The puzzle is that the cosmological constant is essentially the energy of the ground state of the universe. Okay, and so what you would, so naively, before you did anything else, you'd just do dimensional analysis again, like we did for the Higgs, and we're going to get in the same kind of trouble. Okay, because we'd say, look, what's the, you know, what could it be? I'll call it lambda. Could be mp to the fourth. Okay, well maybe we're not that unlucky, but we already know kind of what all the particles and interactions are up to about a TeV. Okay, so at least it's TeV to the fourth. You think? Okay, if we're just going to do dimensional analysis, okay, and when people even, you know, and just the fact that the universe is big, okay, is as big as it is, tells us that in fact this number is less than or of order something like 10 to the minus 46 GeV to the fourth. Okay. We can describe this if you think about your kind of your first field theory course. One of the first things you did was you calculated the ground state energy for just a free particle. Okay. And in general, if you have a bunch of free particles, right, the energy is a sum over all of them, so minus 1 to the F. So it's basically just the sum of their zero-point energies. You know, zero-point energies of their bosons. It's the energy of the filled Dirac C of their fermions. Okay, this is a very divergent expression. If you just cut it off, you say, well, we don't know about physics at the TeV. You're going to make an estimate up to factors of pi and stuff. You're going to, you know, come up with just this estimate. Okay.
No, I know the exponents are big already, but isn't the 10 to the minus
40
inside the
parentheses? Yes, the GeV is, yeah. Thank you. Right. Well, you know, what's the factor of? okay, so this has been a great puzzle, you know, from, you know, and people I say have been troubled by this for a long time. And until recently, the general attitude of most particle physicists and most string theorists was to say, well, this number is so ridiculously small, there must be some deep principle, okay, which says that this number is zero. Okay, because what else could be going on? For better or worse, Banks and Weinberg made another proposal to explain this number. Okay, as they said, imagine a theory. Imagine you have some underlying theory, which has many, many stable or very metastable ground states. We're seeing very means a very means a lot. So they said, you know, imagine that this is the what your theory looks like. Here's V in some kind of space, and it's got. Okay, and there are lots and lots of ground states in this potential. And, you know, of course, this is a caricature, you know, of something. Okay, but they imagine something like this, and they imagine that if you thought just about sort of what the distribution of energy of, let's call it E naught or lambdas, okay, what will it be? Well, you know, you'll have a whole lot of these points, you know, dense, you have a lot of these, you'll have a dense set of these points, so you have different possible values of the energy, and then they said, look, we're considering nowadays theories of inflation, theories in which the universe is really much larger than what we just see looking out to our horizon, so you might imagine that, you know, some meta-universe, as people like to say, that these states are all populated. And basically what they then asked, and Weinberg, I think, asked this most sharply, is what values of this cosmological constant are consistent with the fact that we're here? And he asked this in the primitive way of just asking whether or not you form galaxies. Okay? And basically what you find then is that the cosmological constant has to be less than or of order, something a little larger than what was measured. I don't remember the number. It's about 10 to the minus 46 again, maybe a little bit bigger. Maybe 10 to the minus, I forget the number. But in any case, not too far. At that time, by the way, the conventional wisdom was there wasn't a cosmological constant, and there was no firm observational evidence for it. Okay, and so you predicted in this kind of picture that the cosmological constant would be kind of as large as it can be, compatible with this formation of structure. Okay, and indeed, now, you know, a decade later, okay, in fact, the cosmological constant was observed a little smaller than this. I like to say that that what these guys predicted, roughly speaking, they didn't quote it this way, of course, was that something like log lambda over GeV to the fourth, I think they predicted was minus 103, and I'm even going to invent some error bars, so plus 0 and sort of minus 2, okay, and the observed number is minus 108. Okay? So on a logarithmic scale, you know, we could worry about the details, but on a logarithmic scale, they did pretty well. Okay, and what's remarkable, and what, you know, a lot of people don't like this, but what's remarkable is, A, this is the only explanation anybody's offered that's at all plausible for why this number is small, and, you know, arguably they predicted it, despite what Bert Richter says in the current physics today. Okay? So, and I should say, to explain what that is, I think the issue is the fact that they said it should really be about as big as it can be. They didn't just say it has to be less than this. Okay. They said it should be as big as it can be compatible with this kind of argument. Okay. So, okay, so great. So this, none of us like this. No one really likes this. So certainly not when they first meet it, and few people leave it after a while. And my response to this was I first invented a model for this, showed that this model had no realization in string theory, and said, well, this probably isn't right. This whole story probably isn't right. Then Joe Polchinski and Raphael Busso here came up with a much more plausible version. Okay, and what they said basically is, suppose you have a theory with a lot of these fluxes. Okay, so imagine you have 100 fluxes. I apologize, I'm probably going to run about 5 minutes over. So imagine you have 100 types of fluxes for the sake of argument. Okay, and then imagine that, say, every one of those fluxes takes some discrete value. Imagine they can take 10 values. Okay, so then they said, well, now we have the possibility of having 10 to the 100th states like this. And that's kind of where you want to be. If you want to explain a number this small, where your fundamental scale is 10 to the 76 or something in these same units, okay, you want to, yeah, you've got to make this very fine. Okay, Joe and Raphael dubbed this a discretium. Okay, you need to have lots and lots of states. And so here was an argument. Okay, I still relaxed for a little while because I said, we have never seen anything like this in string theory. All the moduli have to get stabilized. All kinds of things have to be happen, and I refused to worry. But sort of the breakthrough here came, unfortunately, a couple of years ago with the work of Shani, Renata Kolosh, Andre Linde, and Sandeep Trivedi, who actually did give a construction in string theory, kind of similar to the thing I described in the 2A theory. Okay, in this case, they did it in 2B. And they, in fact, constructed an argument that gave a construction which is somewhat similar to this 2A story, okay, in which there were an exponentially large number of states for just this kind of reason. And whereas in the picture I showed before, you could show, or at least argue strongly, that the moduli were all stabilized. Okay? And more than that, you could argue that there really was a distribution of quantities like this, of cosmological constants like this. Okay. All right. So you can, if you don't like this story, there are a lot of ways out. Okay. So I should just say you can leave now. You can argue that first of all, you might not like string theory. Maybe whatever is the right theory doesn't have this feature. But even in string theory, there are lots of questions you can ask about the approximations that go into this. The approximations that go into this, about whether or not these kinds of methods are really, and people ask these questions. But in this famous poll that was taken at Strings 2005, the real question which string theorists were asked was whether or not they believe this exists. And almost all of them did. Almost all of them said they didn't believe that you should use the anthropic principle for everything, but they all believe this structure exists. And it looks quite plausible. Okay. Now there are, I should say, you can at this point sort of take the high road, okay, argue that, we don't understand this well enough, let's keep working on the fundamentals of the theory, and maybe some more attractive answer to these questions will emerge. Okay, I would just say I'm impatient, okay, and so I want to think about what this means. There are, I should say, questions you might ask about this, more phenomenological questions. And that'll kind of... Okay, so there are some phenomenological objections, okay. One of the things that happens in this story is, at least when you first look at it, is it's not, you know, here, not just the cosmological constant is a random variable, but all the constants of low energy physics look like random variables. Okay? And so what does that mean? So if that's really true, then basically how do they get fixed? Well, this is kind of depressing. Okay, so either they all have to be fixed anthropically, you might imagine, or you might imagine they should really literally be random. Okay, so the good news or bad news is that in fact it's pretty hard to see how all the constants of the standard model could be fixed anthropically, and they don't look very random. Okay, so you might, again, as I say, you might stop at this point. Okay, and say, this story just isn't going to work. Particular example of this that I think is kind of gives some focus is this theta QCD again, which in this case doesn't look like it's zero; it looks like a random variable. Okay, but again, I say I'm impatient, and I'm also this story is just sort of too interesting, I think, to just set it aside, even for these reasons. And we could imagine, and in fact, this is perhaps the clue. So either the story is wrong, or this is perhaps a clue to how to look at it, how to think about it. Okay? And I'm not going to, again, because we don't have time, I'm not going to say too much about what sorts of clues, what sorts of answers they might have. But again, this is the kind of thing that people in this workshop are exploring. So I'm I've run out of time, so I'm not going to mention a couple of the other things I was going to talk about. But let me. But if I suspend my disbelief, what I might like to do is return to the puzzles of the standard model. Okay, and to ask whether or not we get some insight and perhaps a prediction, okay, from thinking about these. And my and people, and I usually return when I say this, I return usually often to supersymmetry, and people say, well, you know, you wrote a lot of papers on supersymmetry, that's why you do this. But I actually would sharpen that and say that actually, if we want to think about this question, okay, well, you know, the whole story doesn't make sense if we don't get three generations in the standard, you know, in the standard model gauge group out. The questions we'd like to ask are the things we don't know about. So I have to. So I assume that Michael, and I actually want to give a lot of credit to this, in this, to what I understand in this whole story, to Michael Douglas, but Michael and other Miriam Svetic and the other people have been here, many other people here are going to convince us, Herman Verlinde are going to convince us eventually that there are lots of three generation models or there aren't. Okay, so we have to have the right degrees of freedom, but assuming we have the right degrees of freedom, then we want to start thinking about what additional degrees of freedom there are. Okay, and to do that, I think we want to first think about the Lagrangian, the effective Lagrangian. And if we think we've just sort of got the standard model and maybe a little bit else, then the things we want to think about, we want to think first about the most relevant operators. Because the most relevant operator is the cosmological constant. We dealt with that for better or worse. Okay? So the next one is the Higgs mass. Okay, in the standard model. And so the question is then how do we address that? Okay? And there are good reasons to think that any of several things happen. So there are good reasons for all of these. That one possibility is that the Higgs mass is just another anthropic variable. Okay? I view this as a particularly depressing outcome. Okay, this has been advocated by Demopoulos and Arkani Hamed and others. Because that view suggests that there need be no additional degrees of freedom in the theory that we're going to turn on the LHC. And but Gordy will assure us that this cannot possibly happen, so don't worry. But we're going to turn on the LHC and nothing will happen. So this is, when I mentioned my optimism and pessimism, this was that was the pessimism here. But there are also reasons to think that something like some of these other things I talked about happen. And then, in fact, there's a good deal of evidence that such things might happen. So there might, for example, be, I won't say supersymmetry. Next, I'll say warped spaces. It's an explanation which has been offered for this small MH. And this is something that, in fact, Michael and his collaborators were among the first to provide evidence for. And there certainly is very much the possibility that supersymmetry, just in the way we've imagined it, might also, this low energy supersymmetry might also arise here. Okay. Now, I'll just end maybe by saying, well, I am, well, most days, an optimist. And I spend a lot of my time these days, some fraction of it, trying to think, and I'm trying to get other people to think about these things here, which, you know, is there a way we could decide this question in advance? Okay. And there might be. Okay. Joe mentioned in his talk and at our conference here, and I've also mentioned, one possibility has to do with stability. So basically, what everybody does is they find some potential that looks like that, and they look for the stationary points, they find the stationary point which looks nice, and they declare a victory. Okay. Well, most of the time, most of these things aren't stable. That most of these things will, even if they're locally stable, okay, they'll decay instantaneously. They're not really states. Okay? And so one question is, so when are things states? Well, things are likely to be states in situations where things are extreme. We typically say there's a symmetry or a small parameter. So there's supersymmetry or a small coupling or something else. And so one thing one might try and do, one program, is to try and enumerate, okay, the regions of this landscape, okay, where states really reside, and to ask whether or not once you start putting all these ingredients together, okay, there's some one can make some guess, or maybe better than a guess, about what the outcome is. Okay, so I could go on. I'm having a good time, but I should stop. And I apologize, I've gone 10 minutes over. And I'm happy to take more questions, but also to let people go. And I'm happy to address anything that happened on Friday. I'm in a mood on that subject. Budget for this program.
Are you satisfied with that?
In what regards?
This is exquisite.
Not really. Where's it going, really?
Okay. I think every organizer would answer this differently. Mm. Okay. Yeah. I would answer it. I mean, I really think, and I have been trying to sharpen this, I really think I would like to focus the question this way. I actually would like to think about this question of if this whole approach makes sense, the degrees, there's enough evidence that we can get the right degrees of freedom. Okay. We're 2 years away from starting to see data from the Large Hadron Collider. Can we make some decisions? And there is, in each of these contexts, there's a finite structure of what things look like. Okay, it's not if you talk. I don't want to. I shouldn't just invoke names. So if you talk to Ed Witten, for example, okay, so Ed will say, when I say, this is what we should be trying to do, and Ed says this. Ed says to me, A, you're probably not going to succeed in doing it, and B, if that was all you could do, it's still a great disappointment. We have this beautiful theory, we're going to get everything out of it. Okay. I would be quite happy. So my own view is I would be quite happy to get everything. There are, to get some limited things. I'll settle for this. Life's finite. I'll go for part and let people figure out, how one thinks about the rest of this. And I think these are questions we might answer. Okay, so I describe, for example, a lot of these things are, there's questions, is it science and it's science? There's science at the level that I can really write down equations. There are well-posed questions I can ask in each of these things. Whether it really has anything to do with what we see in the world is another matter, and whether we can make it a logically complete story is another matter. So that's my view. A lot of the people who have come to this workshop have a very different view. They really think, no, we're just going to figure it out. We're going to find. They sort of say, let's close our eyes, and I'm very sympathetic to this point of view. Let's close our eyes to this problem. We're fooling ourselves. This is not the important thing somehow. And let's just see if we can find. We know how to construct many, many more things that look nearly realistic. Let's look at those, and maybe something is going to jump out at us.
The question I would have is, let's say we know that, or I'm interested in a particular minima, that can we actually work out the low energy physics and get ratios of masses, and yes. Do we have to assume there's symmetry breaking?
I'm going to let Gordy say something in a minute, but let me say something first. Because I'm getting to say a few of the things that I didn't say. Okay. So I would say the answer. I would say Gordy will say the opposite. I would say the answer is no. Okay. Actually, the answer is not no in the sense that if you find a state, you can't calculate everything. But the problem is you can't find the state. Okay. So you line up your graduate students. There are a lot of graduate students here, right? You line them up and you say you give them each a barcode for one of these states. And you go and you say start calculating. First thing you do is you calculate the cosmological constant. Okay. So they go away, and they come away after 6 months, they've calculated the second order correction, it looks pretty good. They come away 2 years later, they calculated the third order. 20 years from now, they come back, I'm sorry, 18th order, it didn't work. Okay, throw this out, and you have no clue. In this story, you have no clue, there's just this random distribution. If it wasn't this one, it's not the next one that's good. Okay, so you have no clue. So my attitude is no. My attitude, I don't know if Michael's still here, but my attitude is you should do what Michael has advocated, which is you want to do statistics. You want to ask if there are correlations between different properties that you find. Okay, and for example, you could ask, the kinds of questions you could ask are, is there a correlation between this and this? Is there a correlation between supersymmetry and the scale of supersymmetry and this? Are there finer correlations? And there are, within subsets of these states, there are such things. Are there correlations? Another kind of question Michael and I have to do, the correlation between three generations and the standard model group, between, you know, so my attitude is that's what you're going to look for. Having said that, I'll let Gordy say, Gordy, there are a lot of people who believe we'll calculate everything. Gordy is one, and I, you know, I'll let Gordy speak for that too, but I think, so for me, you know, as I said, I mean, I kind of switched sides in this story at some point. It's not totally a pretty story. It's not what I dreamed of. But let me actually say one other thing. One other thing I think is really neat about this. There is something that I think is really exciting about this for people who have worried about these kind of questions. Is for years and years we've talked about something called naturalness. Particle physicists say this all the time. And when I first heard about naturalness, I heard about it. I think it was Lenny Susskind. I heard it sound. I was a grad student. I was a kid. And I imagined, you know, he described this problem of the Higgs mass, and I imagined this thing with a beard just, you know, the dials. And what the point of naturalness was is this being with the beard wasn't supposed to have to work that hard to get nature to come out. Now, but if you think about it, really implicitly what you're doing when you think about naturalness is you're imagining there's a distribution of possibilities of some kind, and you're selecting from that. Here it's very explicit. So for example, one of the starting points of all these discussions was to say, the way you can get small numbers was, you know, something like this, where G is small, and you say, well, G can, you know, so what are you imagining? You're imagining, well, G squared is roughly uniformly distributed. Well, Michael showed us, right away, lots of examples in these cases, you calculate the distribution of G squared, it's roughly uniformly distributed. Okay, so these kind of notions of naturalness actually have a very explicit realization. And also, but we've also understood the ways they might fail. Okay, we've also understood that, you know, yeah, that may be fine, but you know, maybe there's just a lot more of some other thing out there, and we have examples of things like that. So from my perspective, a lot of questions that people have sort of speculated about for a long time become rather sharper, or at least sharper, and better posed. But we're not there.
Anyway. Well, okay, briefly, I would say that the exciting thing today is that the first time that you make a list of all the interesting questions that you think should be answered by a fundamental theory. Today, every one of them is being addressed by people in quantitative, calculable ways, and it's difficult in many cases, but people at the workshop are working on all of these questions, including mass ratios and the origin of matter asymmetry. We can make a complete list, and we can look at what's being worked on. Nobody disagrees there are lots of solutions to the string theory equations. That's clear. So the question will be how to interpret that in terms of getting a vacuum and learning these. And what many of us think is that there will be classes of solutions in which you have the same answers for all the questions. And that.
But the question is, if you had the right one, would you know it?
There isn't going to be one single way.
Universe.
There's going to be a set of vacuum that are similar. Now, we don't know exactly how to interpret that. They're going to give the same answers for everything, and we have to learn. It's a physics question, though. How do we interpret that? It's not a philosophy question or something else. It's a real physics question in the context of a real theory that is being built up from all sides, and it's something that is being approached completely scientifically. And the progress is huge in the last few years.
Once this Pandora's box opens, it is true that there is no guarantee that there will be any predictable correlation beyond what we know the same amount.
Right.
It's also possible that there will be, except for the cosmological constant, everything will be predictable.
Right.
But it's
right. Right.
There are lots of irregularities and clues beyond the standard model. Unless you assume they're all coincidences, we're going to make huge progress.
I had written here something in my notes to myself here. I had written this optimism and pessimism. I had three kinds of optimists. There's Gordy.
and we'll figure out what I'll say about everything, and we'll find all the answers soon. There's me, we'll understand everything.
Enough about the statistics over the next 2 years to say that low-energy supersymmetry or warp dimensions or something emerge and maybe say a few things about their phenomenology.
Yes.
There's your director, who says all this ugly stuff with its incomplete predictivity will disappear. And then there's the pessimistic view, which is me some days, and I won't name the people I wrote down here. We won't find the correct state, the statistics won't be accessible, and we'll give up. I don't know if people really give up. I will give up. And I would say that most of those participating in this workshop, I also wrote here, are optimists of one or the other of these two types I first mentioned. Okay, and in terms of things that are going on here, one of the questions which I didn't talk about is one of cosmology, which clearly impacts, you know, what we mean by this whole story is not at all clear. And this is something, we've had beautiful talks on this by Steve, Joe is going to explain it all to us Wednesday. So there are lots, you know, there are other kinds of questions of cosmology which also attacked a lot of tension, which I didn't talk about, inflation within these frameworks, other kinds of cosmological issues. So I would be very happy to answer a few of these questions, you know, and I don't think that's impossible, but we're not guaranteed to succeed. And it could also be that this is, we are really barking up. I mean, I could list for you a lot of reasons why we could well be just barking up the wrong tree. And we'd probably be all happier if that in the end.
Thank you. Thank you.